Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, on the internet at hallel.info. In this study, we explore how Joseph, Caleb, and Yeshua, Jesus, each faced suffering and testing, yet chose to trust God's plan over their own desires. Judah's heartfelt plea for Benjamin shows true repentance and growth, while Caleb's wholehearted faith is rewarded after years of waiting. Yeshua's suffering brings ultimate glory to heaven and salvation available to all. Together, these accounts reveal how God orchestrates even our free will choices for His redemptive purposes, calling us to maturity, unity, and wholehearted devotion to Him.
Genesis, it covered Joseph and Judah's interaction, their conversations taking place in Genesis. And we have Joseph, of course, obviously being like a king or near king state in this storyline. And Judah's giving his plea, his discussion or conversation as far as why Judah should be taken place of in order to save Benjamin. So this argument takes place, not a very good argument for the word. It is kind of like an argument, a persuasive discussion, persuasive argument. And we have later on, we have a similar, so that's Genesis. We have in Joshua, we have Caleb. In this case, Caleb's giving his argument. And Caleb's argument is focused on factual information. Hey, this is what took place. We had an issue with way back when, 45 years earlier, discussing the details about the seeking out of the land of Canaan and all the proof text that Josh was there for when Moses said, hey, now it's yours. So Josh was, Caleb's just bringing back to his memory or recollection the details that took place then. So argument takes place there, or convincing argument takes place there. In the case of Luke, we don't have that. In the case of Luke, there really isn't an argument discussing about, there may be some, but it's not really discussed very in much detail about why, what was going on there. It does allude to it, that Jesus does spend some time explaining some of the details about through Moses and the prophets, which of course, book Luke does not record what he said, but nice if he did, would have helped probably a little bit, but maybe not. By the way, there was something that did take place here, is that Messiah did point out that you're to suffer these things in order to receive glory. So glory was actually one of his topics he discussed. In the case, in order to get the glory, he had to go through a sequence of suffering. In the case of Caleb, he suffered, so to speak, in a manner of speaking, in the 45 years of waiting for his fellow Israelites to grow up and, you know, be what they needed to be and get rid of the previous generation. He had a somewhat argument or experience before he received his inheritance, which was his own form of glory. That case was the land that he got from Hebron. So in this case, they do have certain similarities. In the case of Genesis and Joseph and Judah, Joseph had to go through a lot of different sufferings or struggles in order to get the position he was in. Obviously, many years of with the Potiphar and the dungeon and all that stuff he had to go through, and the selling of being sold by his brothers before he received his glory, which of course was being second only to Pharaoh. So we have these examples of some of the main characters, as far as some of the similarities with what they went through, the suffering they had to go through. Then, of course, you have Judah and his argument with Joseph and Caleb's argument with Joshua. So we have certain commonalities between these different sections. So those are kind of the core outline I wanted to just bring to you as far as why they're tied together. Now we get into this a little bit in detail. So the case of Judah. So those of you who study your Bible fairly thoroughly over the years, you will have noticed that there's only so many instances we have of very good arguments, meaning very thorough or well thought out or well expressed arguments within inside of our Bible. Judah's argument, as far as I have read or can tell, tops them all, meaning it is the most complete, most honest and sincere argument the Bible records. And there may not be other, maybe others that are very, very good too, but Judas is the best. And I'll explain why he's the best, because he did something that most of us would never do. And that's what I want to bring up to you today on Judas' argument discussion before we discuss or go too much detail with Caleb and Luke. So let's discuss Judas' argument here. So Judah comes along and he discusses initially, he has a few different points he brings up. One of the primary points he brings up is that, hey, everything is directed toward toward Joseph. So Judah's argument is, hey, so Judah and his 12 brothers, or sorry, at the time, Benjamin wasn't with them at the time. So he had 10 brothers with him initially, before later on, it eventually becomes 11 because of Benjamin showing up later. So initially, Judah's 10 brothers come with him. They come before Joseph. So, well, Joseph on a little chair here because he's king. Give him a hand. And he has, you know, a little throne, right? I'm giving him a little scepter, whatever. And then we have obviously the 12 brothers. Sorry, I keep saying that. It's 11 men. They're not 12 yet. And all the before him. So they're going through this process of presenting themselves. This is the initial interaction they have. The initial interaction, this is obviously a number of chapters earlier. They go through a discussion as far as we're here to buy food Joseph goes through his inquiring and accusing them and all that kind of, you know, spy gobbledygook that Joseph throws at them because he's testing them for various reasons. But Judah's argument does not discuss all those details. He discusses initially, hey, we came here and we essentially did and repeated to Joseph everything Joseph asked of them. You, Joseph, asked us these questions. You, Joseph, put upon these requirements. You, Joseph, required us to bring Benjamin back, and you, Joseph, were instigating all of the events that took place around our story here. And the point being is that Judah is pointing out Joseph, not that he doesn't know who Joseph is at this point in the story. Joseph, you are the one that is responsible for us being in this position here now and today, telling the truth. And of course it is. Joseph knows that's the case. Of course, he put him on this. This is all honest arguments. And the point I'm bringing up to Judah's initial argument is he's pointing out all of these scenarios, the scenario which we find ourselves in right now, is directed at Joseph, you put us here, as opposed to us doing it ourselves. So it's putting upon the authority. We were obedient, trying to obey you, the person who's in charge. So that's an honest argument, an honest discussion, honest example. And that's a good place to start, because it points out that they are being subservient. And Judah's pointing out we have been servant style in our form. Instead of arguing with you or fighting with you or resisting or running away, that kind of stuff, we've done what you asked us to do, even though it was difficult. We still did it as best we could, as a true servant does. That's what you. So Judah is humbling himself in that position. He then continues on and goes through a next sequence, or throughout this conversation, a sequence of events. In the form of, in particular, regarding Benjamin. He focuses a lot about Benjamin and of course, Judah's father, Jacob. And that he appeals essentially to Joseph's softer emotional appeal. Because realistically speaking, in Judah's position, think about it. You have zero logical argument to prove innocence. Nothing. You can't say we didn't do it. You can't say it wasn't true. Wasn't me. I was framed. They have no knowledge, no ability to argue at all. There's no justification that a person could say, well, we deserve mercy for this reason, that reason, because of whatever. There's nothing. And Judah doesn't bother trying to do that. It's a waste of time. It actually tends to be an injustice if he did grant mercy based on a logical argument. That's the wrong approach. And Judah knows that's a wrong approach, so he does not approach a logical argument, because you can't. You can't say, Benjamin didn't do it. Sorry, the evidence is right there. There's no way. You can't say I saw so-and-so sneaking in his pack. There's no eyewitnesses, nothing at all. So he has nothing to work with. He's just strictly, I'm going through a sequence of, this is the series, events that took place. I cannot argue that aren't true. What I find fascinating is that Judah does know that, and he says, I'm not going to use those styles of arguments to justify anything in my actions. Now, think about yourself in your own lives. How many times do you justify your action? All the time. I will say, okay, knowing my head, okay, this probably wasn't my best choice. I should have done something different, but I will justify myself because da 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 da. I'll give it some excuse, some reason, some justification where I'm not as bad as it looks, blah, blah, blah. None of that garbage. Judah knows better. Don't do that. So instead he focuses on, hey, we have a father who's very old. He has a child who got when he was very old. is an old age child. The child is very young. Benjamin, of course, we could argue what young means because Benjamin has like 8 kids at this point in time. He's not that young, but the point is he's using the voice of young. He has his dead brother. He's the only, he's all alone from his mom. His father really loves him. Basically, all these are designed to appeal to Joseph's emotions, not his logical argument points. And Judah knows that, and that's what Judah is throwing on it. He's throwing basically an emotional argument. I, Judah, could not go back without Benjamin and live with the pain that I would cause my dad. And of course, he would probably die in his sorrow. And Judah is pulling all these heartstrings in the argument. It's a beautiful argument. And of course, because it happens to be Joseph, that Judah knew that, Joseph falls. You can't resist this type of argument because the love he has. And I want to bring this up to you because this is the part that's fascinating with Judah, the man of the character. So I raise a few of these things. Says Judah did something in his life. A lot of things happened in his life, of course, but something has changed in his life. Recall years earlier. So years earlier, you got the brothers. They're all, they have their pit that's on here. There's a big hole in the ground. And they threw Joseph way down there. Screaming and yelling, wah, get me out of here, right? And they were ignoring it. Of course, eventually saw. At that point in time, was Judah or any of the brothers concerned about the emotional well-being of Jacob? Not at all. None. Did they care at all about Joseph and his well-being? Not really. Reuben tried to have some kind of argument. Oh, I'll try to sneak him back to dad type of thing. Make a good graces to dad, so to speak, to make up for my own past mistakes. Realistically speaking, all the emotional pleas that Joseph did way back when in the pit, all the brothers ignored. There was no emotional, the logic. There's that no argument was going to sway their anger toward him. And this part I find is really interesting about this process. At the time of Joseph's pit story, the brothers were not in a unison. They don't agree with each other on what should or shouldn't be done. If you recall correctly, some of them wanted him dead. I don't know how many, but they had. I'll put a little knife in here, right? Knife in his glove. We're to kill this kid. Slaughter him or whatever. And then Reuben, at least Reuben, that's one. I'll put him way over here. Reuben, he wanted to sneak down and sneak Joseph out and take him off to his dad as being the hero, so to speak, right? And then Judah says, let's not kill him. Let's sell him. So we basically have three different primary arguments amongst the brothers discussing what is the correct solution. Obviously, the killers lost the argument. And obviously, Reuben lost his argument. But that doesn't mean that we're arguing. They weren't disagreeing with what they were not in unison with what should or shouldn't happen. So this was the early part of Joseph's story. Now, contrast that to Benjamin's scenario. Benjamin essentially is in the pit. He's going to be a slave, right? That's their perception. What's going to happen? That's the ruling or the decree. In this case, the brothers have all, instead of abandoning him, say, quick, let's run home before we're all thrown to slaves. They all go back to Egypt, say, wait a minute. No, don't do this. We'll take his place. And then Judah says, hey, I'm just take me a place. Because they originally said, hey, when they were first caught, they said, the person who has the goblet will die and the rest will become slaves. They weren't all going to run. They weren't going to flee to home. They were all intended to say, we're staying together no matter what happens. We're not abandoning any one of us. We all stay. Of course, when Benjamin was caught, he said, because the guy, I forget, the steward of Joseph's house had took Benjamin and said, we're just taking him. He's a slave, the rest are free to go. They were going to do that. They're staying together. So we're not abandoning anybody. We're all one. Yes, Lorianne? Yeah, Lorianne said men versus boys. There's two different concepts here. So at this point, even though they were all men, there are men there, but age-wise, but not mentally, emotional-wise at the time of Joseph's story. But in Benjamin's story, they grew up. So now we have men discussing, we're not going to abandon. Yeah, we have wives at home. We have children at home. We have responsibilities at home. I'd rather lose all of that and stick together as my, with our brother. That's a change in maturity, isn't it? By a large margin. It's a very big change. So this contrast between the brothers back then with Joseph compared to the brothers now with Benjamin. So their core emotion and thought process of right and wrong and what is good and what is right has shifted over time, over the span of 20-ish, give or take, years with between the Joseph selling versus now they're looking at him pleading for Benjamin's life and freedom. So that is a shift in Judah. Now I mentioned before, when this place took place and Judah and the brothers sold Joseph, they were not concerned by Jacob's emotional state, right? There was really no care what dad thought. And I'll bring up some points to that. Put yourself in those boys' position. Boys, they weren't boys. They were old, most of them were older than me. But they're in their 40s and 50s. Anyway, put them in their position at that time period when Jacob was showing favoritism to Joseph. At that time, 20-ish years earlier, I'm sure that probably hurt, emotionally hurt them. They were raw or upset because it describes many, many times about their emotional upsetness toward regarding Jacob's treating of Joseph compared to how Jacob treated the rest of them. So there's a very big difference on how they were treated. At that time, I'm sure some emotions were running high, hence that they were throwing out, let's murder him, let's sell him, let's do whatever. They didn't like the kid for all the various reasons, and they have their own excuses and own comments. But in that time period, their emotional pain that they were experiencing, they said that was greater or more important to satisfy or to fix or to address than the emotional pain they would have caused their dad, right? At that time. At this time, Benjamin's story, that's not the case. They'd rather have their own physical and emotional pain brought up to an extreme level, even possibly to death, we're not sure, but at least to a permanent slavery in order to avoid any chance of pain coming to their dad. So their emotion, they have matured a lot. Their love, that's what the major components of love is, not wanting to hurt the person you love. Their love for Jacob increased dramatically over the past 20 years or so of Judah's life and the brother life of all the brothers. So we see that this argument of instead of saying Benjamin's not guilty, he was framed, blah, 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 the same garbage that people would try to throw at you now, so to speak. They've used a connection of love as an argument instead of justification or innocence claiming. And to me, that is a beautiful change, a beautiful development in Alter and who these men became. So Judah now sees and knows, in my mind, the love of what a father is and what a father experiences. And I think one of the reasons for him is that the loss of his own sons really affected him and affected him dramatically in that he tried to protect them. And so that love that Judah developed in the loss of his own sons, and of course with Tamar and the other two twins that he has, those I think are major influence for Judah, but that would not explain the influence of all the other brothers. But they all essentially have a similar type of a mentality. We're together. If you recall, when Benjamin was given the extra food, like five times for the rest of them, none of them really complained and said, oh, how awful is you. I realize that in modern day stories, people will interject complaints and whines, all this childish behavior. But the Bible doesn't record childish behavior. If it had recorded childish behavior, then Joseph would have had his answer. The brothers hadn't changed at all. They were not acting childish way back when Benjamin was getting the extra food and whatever else Benjamin got at that time. So this is a significant shift in how these men saw themselves and how they saw the world around them, in particular, how they saw right and wrong. Love is a dominant player, and not just with Judah, but technically with all of them, because they were all standing side by side in unison on this effort to save their brother, even though it would have lost their entire lives. Their children, their wives, their possessions would have all been gone. They didn't care. Save Benjamin. So even though Jacob may have hurt his sons deeply 20-ish years earlier, the sons clearly over this time period have changed their tune, changed their viewpoint in life. And this is where I think is great in that Messiah's comment or his declaration that greater love is no man than to give his life for a friend. Now I realize Benjamin's more their friend, he's their brother. But at the same time, he's only their half brother because they have other brothers. They're more blood related. But in that comment that Jesus makes, the greatest love is no man life for his friend. That is, it's easier for us as people to say, oh, well, like, for example, the classic example that military guys throw out there all the time, which they think is garbage, but they still throw it out there anyway. Oh, he threw himself on the grenade to save his buddies. Yeah, okay, that's fine. That's fine. That's not the type of thing that Jesus was talking about. Jesus was talking about his friend who actually doesn't deserve it. Like, say, for example, my friend was a murderer and he's on trial for prison, for murder, and he's going to go to prison. Just about that type of, I will stay in his place. Yeah, how many of us would do that? The vast majority would say a big fat zero. The guy, he deserved it. All right, that's the type of gave your life for a friend that is far more difficult to do. The throw yourself on a grenade when putting a grenade stone in there with all your buddies around because they're trying to save them, that's far easier than the other one. The other one is a conscious decision. Okay, I'm thinking this thing through. Yep, this is what the right, I'm going to save this guy because I love my friend, even though he deserved this consequence. I'm going to save him for it. That's the scenario. So we have that scenario going on with Judah and Benjamin. From the viewpoint of all the brothers, Benjamin's a thief. That's just any ordinary thief, a major thief. I mean, you stole a super, super valuable thing from a really, really important guy who has the power to kill you all on the spot. So the really, really bad move, Benjamin, they were all, I'm sure, thinking this is a bad scenario to be in. But instead of them focusing, saying, throw Benjamin under the bus, said, nope, we know the scenario. We know what's going on. It all looks bad, but we will take his place. That's what, of course, Benjamin or Judah's one who's actually arguing the specific individual taking his place. But the reaction is still very similar. This is where I think is the amazing part jumps out. It's chapter 45. So when chapter 45 shows up and Joseph, of course, can't restrain himself. This thing is really the hardest part I think most of us would struggle with. At least I know, well, I shouldn't say no. I suspect most of us struggle with this. Imagine that you are in the brother's shoes. All right. You made all this declaration, you know, take us, save the pain from my dad, all those great things. And then Joseph comes, the guy you talk to, just because he says, I'm Joseph. Beyond the fact that it's mind-blowing at first as you take in the concept, now replay instantly in your mind all the things you did to this man. All the miseries you did to Joseph. And it's not a secret anymore. You can't conceal. He knows everything. How do you feel? The intense shame and embarrassment will be a little bit on the unreal side in my mind. I'll use this in another context. So because Joseph is a messianic figure, is a type of messiah, type of savior, so to speak, in this storyline, he's a messianic figure. Imagine for a minute you are now facing Messiah. And you have to give an account for all the stuff you did, good or bad, whatever it is. But there is nothing he doesn't already know. All the rotten thoughts, opinions, actions of your life, anything you've ever done. You cannot fool him on anything. And not just him, but every around you now knows. We're all there. We're all watching. Imagine the whole world that you know, everybody you know, is now looking at you, all the secrets you once held, the things you were ashamed of, things you hid, the good things you did too, the whole works. Everybody now knows. How's it make you feel? Smaller than a speck of dust. To be honest with you, for most of us, the things, the thoughts we once had, we suppressed those thoughts. That's wrong. You still had them, right? All those arguments, all those things we did, the justifications, the sins, the wickedness, as well as the good and the defense we did. Everything we all did, it's all laid bare. Nothing is secret. The amount of shame or embarrassment would be rather intense, I think, for most people. I'll just be honest, most people would be intense. Because we like to think that we have friends, we have family, people who love us, and we love them, yada, yada, yada. But to be fair, most of our friends and family don't know every single detail, every second of our lives that we did good or bad. That isn't a big thing for us. We don't usually think about that. We check, well, those are unimportant details. They don't need to know type of category. But reality is, we're talking to Messiah or in a later course, God, you're going to know. They're all going to know. Everybody's going to know. And there's no secrets. Secrets are gone. So put yourself in these brothers' shoes. They see Joseph says, I'm Joseph. Is my father still alive? The mind blowing, oh crud. He knows everything about us. Anything we've ever done to him, all the wicked, evil, you know, catastrophe that we put upon this man. Yeah, they're going to shrink away. As records, they kind of shrink away. They start back up. Uh-oh. we're in bad trouble now. So normally this type of, I would expect a sense of guilt and shame, rather intense, and probably more intense than they are familiar with or have had to experience up to this point. And the best part about it was that Joseph didn't respond in the way that he could have. He totally could have just thrown the book at him. So you guys are full of garbage, and just thrown him out, but he didn't. So that intense shame, Joseph, instead of responding as justifiably he could have, and maybe some argue should have in some way, instead Joseph says, don't worry about it. This is all planned. This whole thing, everything you guys did that you thought was your free will all along the way wasn't at all. It was free will, yes, but it was still part of God's plan. God is orchestrating the whole thing. So even though you have all your sins laid bare, so to speak, in front of Joseph, or in front of Jesus, if you want to argue, which you and I will experience at some point in time in our future spiritual existence, all your sins laid bare, all the good and the bad, and mind you, for most of us, there's more bad than good. That's just how it is. For most people, it is. There's more mistakes than successes. All is laid bare, and instead of saying, now I'm going to clobber you for all these things you did, he says, no, don't worry about it. God planned the whole thing. And that's what I think is really fascinating to me about. So you have this concept that we as humans call free will, right? And our concept of free will is that we as people decide any given scenario what we're going to do. Do I want to turn right or turn left? Do I want to go forward or go backwards? I want to say hello to so-and-so. Do I want to, all these things we think is our free will, our choice in life. Do I want to move, live here? Do I want to take that job? Do I want to, whatever I want to do, the whole works, we think of this free will. I chose, and this is what happened, right? God, I prayed to God, talked to him, but I made decisions, and this is how my decisions made through. We call that free will, our sequence of free will. The interesting thing to me is that our Father is so skilled at using our free will choices to orchestrate an entire plan around that. So you got free will times how many people? A few billion along the world, right? But at this point in time, your free will at times, in this case, at that point in time, was 10 men back with Joseph's time, their own free will. They think it's free will times 10. It creates the entire thing. Themselves, should we kill him, sell him, or free him? They chose to sell him. We decide it's a free will. They're making choices. They're making decisions. They want to make their choices of what they want to do versus not want to do. But when they each choice they make, God then uses that choice to make a path that goes all the way and lands where God decides it's going to land. It doesn't matter how the path went, God makes the path. But each choice made, each free will choice made that we think is all of our free will, all of our decision making, and God's saying, yeah, I'm orchestrating every one of your guys' free decision making. That's the age of the argument. Is it truly free will then? Yes, actually, it truly is free will. It's just he's using our choices to map out a sequence of events that's going to occur. And Joseph knows this. That's the best part. Joseph knows this. It wasn't you who sold me. You thought you were doing the decision of kill, sell, free. Oh, I don't know. We'll flip a coin. We chose to sell. That's nothing to do with it. You think this is all your plan, and you acted in your coins, your own free will. You made your decisions, but God used every decision along the way to get me here in order to save your lives. That's pretty impressive. So Joseph makes that realization. Now, one thing I want to point out is that Joseph's first comments when he says, I'm Joseph, is my father still alive? And this is one of his last test, I guess I would argue test requirements, is that, yeah, you have free will, God made you here. My father's still alive. He's double checking. Are you guys lying to me? Is dad still alive? He's really old if he is. He's still alive. If they respond yes, then everything they claimed up to this point is totally verifiable. He'd be checked. Joseph can go back to dad and ask him, hey, do all these details they said, is all this stuff true? He would know because it's verifiable. So that's a great thing that he did that. So I like his comment. It's not like he was gullible and didn't realize dad was alive. He was double checking. Is he actually alive? Are you lying to me or you tell the truth? They say, yeah, he's still alive. Guess what? Now I know you're telling the whole truth. The whole story is legit. And that's when he comes along and says, you're forgiven. Essentially, you're forgiven. The whole sequence, which is beautiful in my opinion, as far as how Joseph responds, is that God, he's pointing out that God did all of these. And as the whole point was to bring salvation to you. And so really, salvation to them. They didn't know that there were 5 more years of famine, right? But of course, Joseph knew. So the salvation sequence of free, this whole free will of God, God's doing this with the whole pit thing, the guys in the pit, right? Joseph is down here in the pit with the guy, with his brothers, right up top. God's doing this orchestration way back when, and even technically before the pit example. God is starting this free will event way back when, all the way to back when Jacob first loved Rachel. God started the orchestration way back then. That emotion that Jacob attached himself to Rachel, of course, eventually to Rachel's children, that same intensity of that love that Jacob was sharing. God was starting the free will choice orchestration essentially 2 generations earlier. He is making it through this sequence. These free will choices are free will, but God is using them, which I think is a beautiful thing. And Joseph realized that. This whole storyline, brothers, either you made your free will choices along the way, God used every single one of them to save you. Now, let's jump this up to Jesus, okay? So I can change just some of these symbols, but not all of them. So in Jesus' case, now we already know that story pretty darn well. In Jesus' case, the whole sequence of events is starting, you know, Adam and Eve onward type of thing, the plan that God had for him when Jesus was going to be born and what was going to happen to him. The free will choice of Jesus, which Jesus brings up in Luke 24, microscopic one liner there. It says, with the death, wasn't it such that, his exact phrase, that the Messiah had to suffer such things in order to bring salvation, whatever these exact words, but to be the Messiah would suffer such things. Oh, that's right. In order to bring his glory. That's right. So Jesus' case is the suffering was designed or was planned to suffering in order to bring the glory that God had reserved for him. And once he died and was resurrected, of course, the suffering would, of course, would bring the glory that was in waiting this, all these, you know, 1,000 plus through 4,000 years, whatever it was, waiting for him to show up to receive that glory. The whole suffering was part of the process. And he points out in this story that, hey, the suffering was a required step. Don't be dismayed that this was part of the process. The free will of all those men who crucified him, ordered his crucifixion and everything else that took place in his life and the persecutions and the beatings and blah, blah, blah. We think of them as, oh, those bad guys, those mean. Free will choices, they're all making these bad choices. And you say, yeah, it was all planned. If it wasn't Jimbo number one beating me on the side, if he said no, God's okay, Jimbo number two, beat him on the side. Okay, number three, okay, we got Jimbo number seven. We got seven. This seven, he's beat. Doesn't matter who does it. The point is it's a free will choice because I'm going to use these free will choices that everybody makes to make something happen. In this case, the glory course results that Jesus received result in our salvation. Our lives being saved, so to speak, in his process of death. So in the case of Jesus, the free will that was happening that took place with Jesus' time period and his death and all that kind of stuff, it resulted in the glory that God reserved for him and of course gave to him. And of course, it results in our salvation. In Joseph's case, the free will also that all the brothers were doing was going to produce the salvation of the children of Israel, his brothers, of course, their families. The free will is still a free will, but God used it in order to accomplish this. And Joseph makes that realization and tells and discloses it to his brothers. And of course, Jesus also says a similar thing, that this was necessary in order to make this thing, the whole process happen. The salvation was planned. Now we ask ourselves, why did God need the salvation to happen this way at Joseph's time? What was the point of it? What was God's objective for that salvation taking place at Joseph's time? We understand Jesus' salvation thing, save us from our own death and sins that we deserve. Well, in the case of Joseph's time, they weren't deserving death from their sins, right? I mean, you could argue with the selling of their brother, maybe they deserve it, but realistically speaking, that was just some of the brothers. In the case of Joseph's time, what were they trying to save them from? Starvation. They were going to starve. They were going to die. That's why. And God planned it decades, 100 plus years earlier, this whole thing was going to happen. And so he's going to save them from starving to death. That was the whole point behind it. And so that was the salvation they're going to see. They didn't know it, but that was the plan. So this case of salvation that was all being planned, God was pre-orchestrating these events to help them to save their free will. I personally, Daniel Agee, have one additional opinion I'm going to throw on this because I think there's one other component that is not disclosed here. In the salvation that took place. And this is controversial because it's my opinion. So not everybody agrees with me. In the case of Egypt, draw a map here. We have Israel, we have Dead Sea, Sea of Galilee, or Canada, whatever you call it. You have the Sinai Peninsula, you know, way down here. Oop, I'm terrible drawing this. It's something like that, Sinai Peninsula. You have Egypt way over here. Put a big E for Egypt on this side. So Israel's in this territory. The Sinai is around some of this funky, like, triangle-ish shape. I don't know how it works. Something like a funky triangle they got going, like the Sinai Peninsula there. Anyway, Israel, the nation, the people, the children of Israel, all hanging around over somewhere near, I personally suspect, you know, probably near the Hebron territory, and it traveled around. They also went up to Beersheba. They hung around the southern half of Israel, typically. And most importantly, if you've noticed before, the men got married. Those brothers had wives, didn't they? A lot of wives in some cases, but they had wives. So what tribal nation category do those wives come from? We don't know all of them. We know some. We know at least two came from Canaanites. That was Judah's first wife and, of course, Simeon's wife, one of his wives. Two are Canaanites, like from Canaan. So they were from this territory, right? What kind of gods and goddesses would be involved in this? Probably quite a few. I don't know all the gods and goddesses of Canaan, so it's not a big deal. The point is they have other gods who are involved here. Well, eventually they have cut. See, Judah, of course, has at least three sons. So Judah gets three. And Simeon has at least one that from the Canaanite women that are recorded. All the other women's biology is not recorded. So we don't know all of them, but we know at least two of them. And of course, there were other people. There were Midianites around, Midian. You have Moab is hanging around just barely. They'll look like probably like their first cousins. There aren't that many generations going on here. They're probably more than first, but second or third cousins. You have Ammons around. You have a few other people, but they're going to intermarry with these women. Now, I'm sure there's probably a possibility. I know in Jewish tradition, just tradition, every wife was re-imported from Aram, descendants of Laban. I don't think so, but that's a Jewish tradition because they didn't like the idea, the fact that they're all intermarrying. What happens when all your sons intermarry with pagan cultures and pagan wives? What happens to your kids? They end up being raised that way. What happens to your grandchildren and the great grandchildren and the great 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 grandchildren? They're intermarrying with the pagan wives. What happens? You get assimilated. That's what happens. It's really common. Most of these cultures got assimilated in their day. They were blended together. Some for mutual self-defense, some for just interacting with wives. You recall when they were in Shechem, and Shechem, the brothers end up killing them. I think it's Shechem and his dad Hamor. It was Hamor. They were decisive. We'll just intermarry. They'll be part of us, a part of them. We'll just be one big happy family. That's the normal culture. So if you leave people in this scenario to be able to interact with Mary and intermarry, you're going to likely blend or dilute the concept of God into a funky hodgepodge blend of syncretism, weirdness going on, right? So one of the greatest things that God could have done is say, I'm going to transplant this Israel. I'm going to transplant them over into Egypt, into a place where the Egyptians hate you. They will not eat with you, as the Bible records. They won't eat in the same chair, the same table. They won't have any kind of interaction with you in that capacity. So this transplantation process was perfect because now you're in a culture that looks and acts so different from you, you will be isolated from them. And of course, you get the land of Goshen, which is right where my error happened to be. What was that? I didn't hear you. Who would want to marry a girl? Right. Who would want to marry a girl from a country who hates you? Exactly. Because they hate you. So the transplantation process was perfect to isolate and prevent, or at least reduce, the amount of intermarrying that would have taken place had they stayed in their own territory. This is an important step that God was using. Granted, it lasted like 200-ish, 210, whatever it is, years, as far as they were there. And while they were in Egypt, of course, beautifully again. They become slaves to Egypt, the last generation or two. And so that slavery also contributes to the continued isolation and containment of the Israelites within a territory of people who don't like them. They will not want to intermarry with each other, but just not saying that the male Egyptian males would not force the women to marry. That does happen. I'm not arguing that point. But as a core group, they're not going to intermarry too much. And so Israel stays more isolated because they're different language, different culture, different systems of belief, the whole works, and they're not compatible with the Egyptians. This is a beautiful move. Well done, God. Checkmate. You did it. So he did it. He does this process. That's the salvation sequence. This is being planned, as he told Abraham, 400 years from now, your children are going to get out of this. But I got a 400-year span between you, Abraham, before they come out. You have a lot of time going to happen here. And this is the process I'm going to make this occur. So this is all, God essentially orchestrated the entire thing all the way along from Abraham, probably before Abraham, onward. He starts alluding to what his plan is. So this isolating, pulling him out of the pagan cultures, say, I'm going to prevent this intermarriage to the Canaanites. I'm going to move them to the territory to isolate them because no one likes them there. Perfect, good move, God. And then 210 years later, now we'll pull them out and they're big enough, they can get rid of these messed up nut jobs that are hanging around in Canaan, right? So God had this thing, whole orchard. Again, is free will involved? Yes, it is. Did God orchestrate their entire free will? Yes, he did. Meaning he used all the brothers' choices, Jacob's choices, even Isaac, Rebecca's choices, I'm sure. He used them all. They're all of free will to orchestrate this exact salvation plan. He's trying to create a people out of Abraham's descendants that are God-fearing. To do that, you can't have them intermingle with pagan, non-God-fearing, non-single God-fearing, polytheists, essentially. You can't intermingle with polytheists for very long because eventually it's going to smear off. Look at Christianity today. A lot of polytheism has bled itself into Christianity in its practices and behaviors because they weren't truly isolated. So this isolation process is a beautiful thing, and God does it. Of course God does it. It's God. Yes, Hannah. If all these are creating the bricks of pyramids, the bricks for Egyptian. She's arguing, hey, if all these were doing slaves and carrying bricks, would they get stronger with the Egyptians? Yes, they probably would physically be strong, but if you malnourish them, they aren't actually strong. So it's kind of a catch-22. It's what how slavery works that way. You make slaves really strong, but you keep their nourishment down to a minimum. Their strength is not very useful to them because they can't really do all that much. Some can, but most can't. What was that? Oh, grow a garden. You're right. Slaves grow a garden, which they talked about. They had their leeks and such they had. So the slavery is its own weird thing, Hannah, so it's really hard. It's a complicated discussion about what people do in slavery. So the pre-planned events that I want to point out to you, that's really important. God was pre-orchestrating this entire storyline. Now let's jump temporarily or briefly to Caleb's story, because even in Caleb's story, which we got this, I think mostly settled out what God was doing. Caleb's story is also pre-planned in its own right. And Caleb's story is saying, hey guys, hey Joshua, I get my land that Moses said, right? So I mentioned before, Caleb uses his argument to discuss factual information. He does not use the emotional appeal that Judah uses or the brothers use, because Caleb has actually facts to support him. And of course, Caleb was bringing up logical arguments, but he was earned the territory that he got to keep. So in Caleb's story, he didn't have to deal with emotional arguments. It was just straight factual information. But he pointed out the reason that he gets this. My marker's almost dead. The reason Caleb receives and gets this territory of Hebron, right? So the reason, because my heart, Caleb's already saying that my heart was whole with God. It was whole with God. That's the reason Caleb's saying. It wasn't about, Caleb's extra strength, extra whatever, just his heart being whole with God. So in Caleb's story, this is an important theme. I want you to understand this here. His whole heart, that is his reasoning why God said, this is yours. Yeah, he did everything right. He said, hey, yeah, this is good territory. He was a good spy, all kind of good stuff. But realistically speaking, his whole heart was the reason he says, this is why I get it. And I want to bring this up to you because I want to bring the reason why I believe or suspect, I should say, why Joseph also came to a similar conclusion, why the glory he received from being Pharaoh's second in command, so to speak, Because in unlike some of us, myself heavily included here, to try to defend ourselves, Caleb, Joseph, and Jesus all essentially said, "Your will be done, God. You decide. You do what you do. You just be, my heart is what you want me to do." And I say that because Caleb could have easily said, "Oh, you guys are going to hang out for the next 40 years. I'll catch you later. I'll catch you on the other side. I'll be in my land. I'm taking off. See you in 40 years, guys, and go live his life. He said, "No, I'm going to stay with this congregation for the next 40 years of wandering, and stick this thing out." His whole heart was there. And Joshua reiterates that, yes, that is the reason that Moses gave you this land, that the territory Hebron, because your whole heart was there. All the gifts, the glory that Caleb was going to receive was because of his whole heart in it. And I'm not going to go too much detail into that because that's almost self-explanatory. Both Caleb says it. Joshua agrees that's the reason. So his whole heart was behind it. And of course, the case of Jesus, Jesus had to suffer, right? So Jesus suffers. So Jesus, marker's not very good either. Jesus suffers, right? Write this thing down. Okay, that works. Jesus suffers. Now, Jesus has a similar scenario as mentioned before to Joseph, right? So in the case of Jesus, he has decisions or choices to make. Am I going to go through all this or not? We even have his prayer. He talks about, "God, take this away if you can. I don't want to do this. This is hard. This is terrible. But your will be done, not mine." So Jesus didn't want to go. Nobody wants to do through a miserable death. Who wants that? We want to, you know, let me die peacefully, right? We all, you know, let me die in my sleep, which almost never happens, but we still like it. The idea. She says, "No. So I'm going to go through this horrible, miserable experience, uncomparable to most things." He doesn't like, doesn't want that. It's like, "Ooh, yay, sign me up. I'm on the dotted line" type of thing. He just a bit agreed to it because, as it points out, he learned obedience through suffering. So he learns to obey and want to follow God anyway and go through this process. So was Jesus essentially, his whole heart, much like Caleb, was in it? Now, Jesus could have said no. We know that much. He could have just said, "No, I'm not doing this," and walked away. But he opted not to. "I'm not going to say, God, your will be done, not mine." He could have said, "Nope, God, I'm doing my will. Catch you later. See you on this side," and take off. When Satan tempted him, right? He could have said, "Okay, deal. We'll go that route." He totally could have done that. He opted not to. He said, "No, my whole heart was with you." And as a result, he receives his glory that God had reserved for the man who would say, "Yes, I'm going to follow." So Jesus gets the glory that God reserved for him. Caleb receives, because his whole heart was with God, Caleb receives the land that he wanted. Hey, I walked it. I earned it, so to speak. So Caleb's whole heart was with him. He received the land. In the case of Joseph, I'm sure he wasn't thrilled about being in prison for however many years it was. I don't think it records the number of years. But Joseph's whole heart was with him. What did Joseph get? As long as he has his whole heart with him, Joseph receives essentially, he's not technically king, but close to it. So he's king-like. I'll put king-like, he's not technically king. By technicality, Pharaoh was king in name only. But king-like experience, that was a glory that Joseph receives. So all these men, Caleb, Joseph, Jesus, all have a similar experience. They say, "I'm not going to follow my will. I'm not going to do my choice. My free will is to choose God's will." That's what they're essentially doing. My free will, which they all have free will, examples of free will, the people who murdered Jesus, the people who were with Caleb, the other spies that, "Let's run away, run away, run away. Oh, just avoid the land." Joseph could have said, "Forget you brothers, I'm killing you all off." They all have free will. Joseph, of course, also free will. They all have free will involved in their stories. But these are men whose free will said, "I am choosing to set my personal desires aside, my personal fears aside. I'm going to do, God, what do you want me to do? I'll go do it. What do you want for me? I'll go do it. I'll make it happen. Just, it's my will is now yours, God. Just name it. I'll go do it." And very willing to do so. And that's what I think is a great example, contrast between good men who made difficult choices in their free will options, and they experience evil upon them from other men's free will choices, but God uses all those free will choices to give awesome gifts. Who wouldn't want to be king of the most powerful country on earth? I would love to say, "Hey, would make freedom for everybody. I'd have a blast, right? I'm not mean. Who wouldn't want their own lands to live in? Hey, this is yours. It's yours. Do what you want to do with it. That'd be great. Cool. I'll fight for it. I'll make it happen. Who wouldn't want the glory God reserved for you? So this is yours. This is all the strength and the needs and the love that you needed here. It's all yours. Who wouldn't want that? Most say, hey, I great to have all the love and all the strength that I needed to make the best choices possible, and every choice I make is good, is right, is perfect. That's pretty awesome. With no mistakes. That'd be cool. To allow people to save people's lives like Joseph did. He saved, who knows how many thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, maybe even possibly a million lives or more that he saved as being king. And of course, Caleb saying, hey, I fought for this. I did my best I could. I followed God. And he's saying, yep, your land, all this territory that you wanted, it's all yours. Do what you want to do with it. You're free. These are all great freedom choices. By setting your will aside and choosing God's will, you get great gifts from God. That's the point behind it. Compared to or contrast that to the men who chose their own free wills, who they thought were truly free, and they made poorer choices, God still used those. So use those poor choices they made because they still have free will, but to orchestrate great gifts for those who gave up their free will for God's free will. So that's what I want to talk about today. Any questions or comments regarding this such a matter? It's pretty straightforward in what's being discussed. All of these scenarios allow people like us to read and observe and learn from that if I choose God's will over my own, better outcomes occur. If I react or respond in kind to someone who does something evil toward me and I do evil back upon them, these gifts are then essentially removed as a possibility for me or anybody else that does that. So I think it's a beautiful thing that as far as maturity and growth in these men weren't born that way. I mean, these men had to work it up. They had to work this process. Jesus had to work obedience through suffering. He had to learn and get through this process. Caleb had to go through, obviously, the years in slavery. He was 40 years old when they left Egypt. He was a slave too. Joseph had to experience all these struggles. They had to work their way from immature children and teenagers into mature men. So they know, I know what's good. I know the difference between right and wrong. I'm going to choose God's will over my own desires. And I'm going to see what God does for me. That's the beauty about it. So they go from immature kids to grown-up, awesome, praiseworthy men who can, as Joseph did, save countless people. And kids have the freedom to do what you want to do, give and help anybody you want. And Jesus, of course, God's glory to save and make sure everybody, make sure every decision made for every human being is perfect.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hillel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info, hallel.info.